You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Scotty Pepper is one of the best known and most respected golf commentators on television. A 17-year veteran of the LPGA Tour, she won 17 tour events and two majors. Injuries cut her playing career short, but she transitioned seamlessly into a broadcasting role. She worked for 8 years for NBC before stepping away to promote junior golf. But she returned to broadcasting a year later with ESPN and has been with CBS since 2016. Her calm demeanor and her voice fit golf perfectly. Later this week, Dottie will be on the mic for ESPN and CBS at the PGA Championship in Kiawah Island Course in South Carolina. Dottie, welcome to Sports Connections.
Thanks so much.
It's a pleasure to have you here. We are we work together with a publisher of your book, and we'll get to that in just a little bit. But I want to start with your background, something I didn't know until I was preparing for this interview, and that's the fact that your dad was a Major League Baseball player. Just talk about your growing up years.
I was a baseball baby. I was born in 65. Dad was signed to a Major League contract right out of high school. Day graduated by the Detroit Tigers. Got called up for a brief stint. I think his first game was actually against the Kansas City A's.
There you go.
Yeah. Yep, and he made the cover of Sports Illustrated as one of the most promising rookies coming out of the spring training in 1968. And although, like I said, he got called up, family was really the reason he left. He was traded to the Expos during the expansion in 70, but never played for them because his dad died and he was responsible for the family's turkey farm. So it was the days when baseball players didn't make a lot of money and most had off-season jobs. And family came first, and there was an opportunity, but he made the decision to stay home.
So turkey farm is not quite as glamorous as some. The one I remember, the offseason job that I think is maybe the best known is Richie Hebner, infielder for the Red Sox. Do you remember what he did in the offseason?
I don't.
He was a grave digger.
No, you're right.
So turkey farm isn't that bad, is it?
No, not so bad. There are a lot of turkeys, but no, that wasn't digging graves.
Okay. Just talk about how you got involved in golf. When and how did you pick it up?
My dad's mom was really how I picked up the game. She, after my grandfather died, who had the turkey farm, she remarried and he was a golfer. And although they didn't stay together, she loved golf. And that was really how I got into the game, was that she loved it so much that she thought her oldest granddaughter would be something that we could do together. And it was also something I could do by myself. So that was equally important. And I loved it from the start, as she got me a series of five lessons when I was the summer that I went from age 7 to age 8, and a set of Chichi Rodriguez Northwestern starter set. A series, like I said, of five lessons with a journeyman professional who was in the area for the summer. A lot of people came through this area in Saratoga Springs for the horses during the summer. They happened to
have a golf course too.
So I was fortunate to have a 9-hole course here in town, a short course where I kind of honed my early skills. And then she bought me a junior membership at the Brookhaven Golf Club, where Mr. Pulver, the subject of my book, designed the golf course, was the agronomist. He did a lot up there, and that's where our paths crossed. So Brookhaven, where you could play junior golf for the entire summer for $100, it's still $200.
Yeah. Oh my.
Yes, so it's become a little kind of incubator of junior golf in this area. So that was my early story.
And that's your tie to promoting junior golf. As I mentioned in the introduction, you stepped away from the broadcasting business to help promote junior golf before getting back into it. So that's probably a part of the reason why is because you were introduced to the game as a junior. Is that correct?
I was. And it was a bit of a debt of thanks too to Mr. Pulver because of what he had done for me as a PGA professional. He was retired at the time, but it was kind of a way to pay him back a little bit to further give into the game. And I served on a lot of committees, communications, the junior golf committee. I jumped all in when I left NBC, and I learned a lot from my time on that board. It was 3-year commitment, and there was a lot going on. But you understand that golf isn't the same all across the country. There are different needs in different areas, and it was really a good thing for me to experience.
Now, did you take to the game right away? I mean, were you good from an early standpoint?
I was. I loved it, but I was. I was also very lucky that my grandmother was the wheels. Both my parents, you know, worked, and she got me around to a lot of tournaments. There were not a lot of junior tournaments in this area. I played in the club tournaments. But as far as being able to play in and around upstate New York, there really weren't that many tournaments. So I played against the ladies a lot and I learned how to do the handicap. I was actually the handicap chairman of the Women's League and learned, you know, really the game from the ground up. And I think that was good, too.
And golf, unlike very many other sports, you could play in a junior tournament or a club tournament against the boys as well. Did you do that, or was it your competition usually against other females?
My competition was almost exclusively against the guys. There was still, until just 2 years ago, there wasn't a high school team in our high school for girls.
Oh, wow.
That really changed. There wasn't a section championship within the public high school section for us to be able to advance to a state championship until 2019. So things are happening around here. I've been really happy to be part of that, making it possible for girls to compete against other girls. But I primarily competed against the boys right from the very first junior club championship that I played in at Brookhaven.
All right, I'm going to ask you a question, but I want you to answer it in your golf announcer voice, okay? And we have the ability to turn you up if we need to. So what drew you, other than being good at it, what drew you into golf? What was it about golf that drew you in? And then now go into your Dottie Pepper on 15 voice.
Dottie Pepper on 15. It's a game you can play for a lifetime. It's a game you can play by yourself. And for me, it afforded me an education. I was the first in my family to go to a 4-year school, get a degree. And golf was that vehicle for me, but I absolutely loved it.
Okay. I was expecting maybe two shots worth, but that's pretty good. Now, you won two majors in your career, both of them, interestingly, the Nabisco Dyna Shore. I guess, first of all, what was it about that tournament that brought out the best in your game?
Wow. It was the first professional major I played in as an LPGA member. I think that was pretty, and I qualified. Now, you had to qualify either by winning a golf tournament or finishing in the top three of an eligible event. And I was not eligible until the day before that week.
Oh, wow.
Because I finished second in Phoenix. Made a putt at the 18th hole to finish second. The first Korean on the LPGA Tour to win beat me that day. But I was all of a sudden in the Dyna. And now I got to change a flight. I have to drive from Phoenix to Palm Springs. I had no hotel room. I flew my sister in. It was wild. So I think that was part of it. But also I was invited to play in that tournament as an amateur in 1985. I had been low amateur in the U.S. Open in 1984 and had a very good college season. But I didn't have the money to play. So I had to turn down the invitation. So I think the two made that tournament very special for me, that I had an opportunity that I had to turn down because I couldn't afford to play. And it was my first one that I qualified for as an LPGA member.
And how many did it take for you to win your first one? You won two of them. I don't remember exactly the years, but how long did it take you to win your first?
So the first I played was 88, and the first time I won was 92, and then again in 99. Two very, very different wins. 92 was in a playoff. The last hole to get into the playoff, and one on the 10th, one inland. So the dive that you see everybody take now into Poppy's Pond never happened. And the second one I won going away. I had a 3-shot lead starting on Sunday, and it got bigger with good play.
Now, did you at that point dive into the pond?
I did. It was colder than I thought. It was a lot dirtier than I thought too.
But it was worth it, right?
Oh, heck yeah.
Where did that tradition come from? I mean, that's not something, golf is such a dignified sport. I don't know if that's the right word, but you know, we talk about golf etiquette. We don't talk about baseball etiquette or bowling etiquette or football or tennis even. Well, I guess tennis etiquette, there's some, but golf, it's called the gentleman's sport. It's called the sport with etiquette. diving into a pond after winning doesn't exactly fit. Where did that tradition come from?
It was started by Amy Alcott, actually. She was the first one to do it, and she wanted to bring Dinah in. Now, you remember Dinah was always perfectly attired.
Oh, yeah. Together.
But Amy wanted to get Dinah in. I think she got her up to maybe up to her ankles or so, but that was all Amy's idea. And I guess it's sort of like, you know, getting the Gatorade dumped on you or whatever, if you're a manager. Or, I mean, that's the celebration. And again, it was dirtier than I thought. There's now a prepared pond with concrete lining. I mean, it is magnificent now, but it was cold too.
And it's always in the same course in Palm Springs, right?
It is. It's at what is now the Dinah Shore Tournament Course at Mission Hills. It was the championship course.
But Palm Springs doesn't get cold. How come the lake could be cold?
Desert evenings.
There you go.
Yeah, they can be chilly. It's early in the year, so usually middle of March, beginning of April. So wherever the spring and spring break and all that sort of happen. There's been Easter Sundays that I remember going to a sunrise service there. So it can float around as that time of the year.
Okay. Obviously we talked about the fact that the injuries cut your career short. When did you decide, or when did you know that you wanted to be a commentator?
A long time ago. I really wanted this to be my plan B, and I was very fortunate that it became reality. I'm a sports junkie. You know, my dad and I used to run to the end of the driveway to see who could get the newspaper first and start reading the box scores and all that. And I'd have been happy doing local sports. I mean, honestly, and here I am. It was something that Judy Rankin helped me a lot with, LPGA Hall of Famer and, you know, one of the greats of broadcasting, period, male or female. But Judy paved a very nice way for me by recommendation and by really by her example. She pushed me a little bit in 99. I'd already won a major championship that season, and the women's amateur was coming to Asheville, North Carolina, not too far from where I was living at the time. And she said, you know, I think you might be okay at this. Would you do it? You're not playing that week. And I said, yeah, I'd give it a try. And I enjoyed the preparation. I enjoyed, now I still enjoy, when Mark Leishman chipped in on the 70th hole at the tournament at Zurich at New Orleans. I mean, I got that buzz up the back of my head like I did when I was playing. It was just,
yeah.
It's really cool. Yeah, you still get to it. And the position that I'm in on the golf course, I still can feel it, hear it, smell it, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Does that feed those competitive juices a little bit to be right there in the action? Even though you're not swinging the club, you're still very much a part of the action as it happens. Does that help?
Yeah, it helps me. It puts me in the zone, which I try to get myself into every day, of making the right call at the right time, of having the right emphasis of just getting in and getting out. Judy's big thing was say as much as you can in as few words as possible. Don't kind of drivel on and force
right.
the show to lag and just be wordy instead of on point.
Well, you've kind of answered this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Just maybe there's something else you want to add to it. Describe your approach to your role as a commentator, especially one who's not, you're not up in the booth, you're not up in the tower. You're walking along the course with the golfers.
I think the key is being prepared going in, knowing the player's tendencies. If they're a low ball hitter, or if they tend to move it right or left, if they have poor bunker play, if they have trouble pitching, if they're lag putting. I mean, all that stuff is available now if you dig just a little bit, and then you call it as you see it. As the weather impacts it, as a player's preparation or a lack of preparation, I often go to the range or just kind of observe, see if there are new clubs in the bag, if there's a new caddy, whatever the changes might be. But I think my job is to tell the folks at home what they can't see, what they can't hear, because there's commercial breaks and we're going to other players. So sometimes players will talk to you in between shots. Often they will. And nobody knows that but me. And maybe the audio guy that heard everything through that might be, but that's the important stuff that we can relay as on the ground reporters that you really can't do from a tower.
Now, you've spent all, as far as I know, all of your career as a reporter on the course, following a foursome or following a twosome or whatever.
In men's golf, yes. In women's golf, I've always been the 18th hole analyst.
Okay. So I was going to ask you if you wanted to be, you know, the Vern Lundquist or the Jim Nantz who are sitting, you know, Jim's on 18, Vern's on 16 at the Masters. You know, that's totally different. You know that particular hole really, really well, and you know where the earlier player, you know, hit it and stuff like that. So your preparation is about a hole or a location or the undulation of the green or whatever, where you're walking with a particular group, you know, that particular group, and you're learning each hole as you go. Which do you prefer?
So I sat at the 13th at Augusta for 4 years and did that whole tower announcer. Jim's completely different because he's really the play-by-play guy that it all rotates.
Right.
And then you have the lead analyst. I like where I am. If I couldn't be in the 18th tower as the main analyst, this is exactly where I would like to be.
Yeah.
So I've worked hard on my fitness. I mean, you got to go. You got to keep up with the players. You're moving. Actually, you're probably moving more than them because a lot of times I'm going diagonal to get out of camera shots and get my information and get out. But I like being outside. I could, maybe that's just the player in me too. And I like being responsible for the whole course. I mean, when you're a tower announcer, like for my example, at Augusta National, I was responsible for the third hole and the fourth hole. And early on, I was responsible for then getting my tail up to the clubhouse to do an interview. So hurry up, get out, get down the ladder and get to the clubhouse for interviews. But I love this gig I've got.
Yeah, I know you mentioned that sometimes the players talk to you when, you know, between shots, so you're not on camera. I'll bet you've had some unique situations with some of those and probably can't share all of them, but do you have any that you want? You have any that you want to share? It maybe, and I'll just pick one that sticks in my head. Mickelson, I think it was on 15 when he was in the pine straw and had to hit that low line drive and put it on the green.
13.
Okay. At least I was on the right course.
Yeah, you were even in the right neighborhood.
Okay. So do you have any situations like that stick in your mind as highlights for you?
I do. And I'll go right back to my first US Open. It was at Pinehurst. I was working for NBC and I was assigned to Tiger on Thursday. And Tommy Roy, the producer, liked to get his announcers in the game early with a report. If they'd gone to the range, get your gear, go to the range, tell us what you thought. So Dot, are you ready for a review? Yeah, I'm on the practice screen. I can do that. And I went through that, you know, Tiger's practice routine was what it normally was. He really, at that time, would play the golf course and you'd see him hit different shots. And you're looking at the whole sheet, knowing that, just visualizing the entire round come to him. And I noticed him struggling with his shirt the whole time. He's tugging and pulling on it like it was too small. So I finished my report with that. And I hear in my ear, that's what you got. Okay, so that's what I got. So he plays the first hole and he's still tugging on that shirt. Second hole, he gets a pair of scissors out and cuts underneath the arms. And now, you know, I'm the hero of all of it, of being doing my homework. And I hear Tommy in my ear going, were those scissors? Were you right? I said, you're darn right. I was right. Since he hit one shot on the range today. So he cut the armpit out.
Wow. That's, you have any others? I mean, I could, we've got an hour. So if you've got other ones, I'd love to hear them.
Well, that's definitely my highlight of just, you know, being prepared. There's another one at another US Open, Dustin Johnson. If you watch him, he almost always wears just white shoes. I was on the range and I said to him, what the heck, red, white, and blue shoes? He goes, yeah. He said, they're catching my eye. So I told the camera guys to keep an eye on it. If he was going back to the driving range or back to the putting green or go back to the clubhouse to change shoes. And sure enough, by the time he got to the first hole, just plain old white shoes again.
The attention to detail is great and something that I don't think most people who watch watch the sport and get to know you through that would know that.
Another example was at the Zurich, the New Orleans tournament on the driving range. I went Sunday, and Louis Oosthuizen has this short little club in his bag. And I said, what is that? He goes, well, it's a 7-wood. My 3-iron used to be my favorite club in the bag. And now I've got this 7-wood that's a 3-iron length. It's bottom heavy. It doesn't look like it's going to hook. So it's got nice shape to it. And he said, honestly, it's the perfect club so many times, not even just full shots, but around the greens. Well, don't you know, within the first half hour that we were on the air, 7-wood came out. It was his favorite club, replaced the 3-iron, boom, 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 boom. So it was just homework and detail.
I've got a 7-wood in my bag. Now, the difference between Louis Oosthuizen, he knows what he's going to do with it. I use it when I'm in the high grass because it's heavy.
His was heavy. I'll give you that.
Yeah, and it cuts through. I'm notorious for looking to see how far my ball goes before I actually hit it, which doesn't work well. But that 7-wood, because it's heavier, it keeps my head down, and I can get out of anything with that 7-wood. So you got to tell the world not only that he had used a 7-wood, but that it was his new favorite club after his 3-iron.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Now, I know your role is to describe the action. How much do you find, and I guess it's probably different with different golfers, but how much do you interact with them during a round?
It depends. Some of them are very chatty. Others are not. I usually get 2 or 3 good hits in on Tiger. Just a little zinger here and there, and he'll zing me right back. One of them I would say, so the Beth Page U.S. Open, so that was 2008. He had just come off, he'd had an ACL repair, and my dog had just jumped off the back porch about 6 weeks earlier and ruptured her ACL. And she was back, no problem, no surgery. We did rehab, away she went. And I said, my dog just jumped off the back porch. It was only like 3 weeks. I'm like, what's the deal with you? And he turned right around. He said, dog around him. He loves his dog. So it's an easy conversation. And he said, yeah. I said, I'm getting old.
Obviously Tiger's one of them. Who are your favorites to follow?
No, I don't really have. Now I always look for the player who has a caddy that's going to help us out first and foremost. With clubs and all, and if they can be remotely helpful, it makes our shows a lot better. I like guys that are just out there getting ready to get at it and play quickly, and not a whole lot of dilly dallying around. And I could watch Louis Oosthuizen hit golf balls all day long. I could watch Adam Scott hit golf balls all day long. Those are the guys that I go out there and if I'm going to go to the range, I'm going to sort of mimic what they're doing. So I still enjoy that just as a golf geek.
I've been to Augusta, never during the tournament, but I've been there and I was impressed with the driving range that's on as you're looking away from the clubhouse. It's on the left of the very familiar driveway. And yes, it's like 350 yards from the tee box to the fence that's by the street. And then it's like a 50-foot fence. And I'm told that some of the pros, especially on Wednesday, will try and drive it over that fence. Have you ever seen anybody do that?
Bryson was trying to do this year. And that driving range used to be on the other side of Magnolia Lane, which is now the members range. And it got to be too small and too short. So they had all this beautiful property. It is a magnificent practice facility. But yeah, you get the right conditions with the wind blowing, helping out of there. It's doable now.
How close have you come?
That's no threat. Not at all.
Describe your game. And I want to get into the book here in a second, but describe your game now. First of all, when you were a pro, what was your best, the best part of your game when you were playing, and what's the best part of your game now?
The best part of my game now is I don't miss many shots because I don't play much. So there you go.
There you go.
Around the game all the time. So I really don't play much anymore because I'm doing all the other things that I had to give up in order to be the best at what I was doing. And so I'm in my garden, I'm skiing, I've gone back and learned a lot more. I've traveled to find World War II, more education there. I'm doing the things that I really couldn't do when I played, and I love it. But I think when I played my best, I just didn't have any weaknesses, David. I really tried to not have anything that was just horrific. I would say if I had a weakness, it was probably pitching the golf ball. But my best year, one of the best years I had on tour, 92, when I was player of the year, I was in the top 10 in driving distance and driving accuracy. So that wow. combination like that is a lot of offense. And that was what I really tried to do, kind of not make silly mistakes, like careless three putts, just not being prepared for a golf course, but really just not have as many, not be many weaknesses.
As a commentator who's walked the course for years now with the best players in the world, what advice would you give to a 62-year-old man who was never any good, who's lost any distance he had because he's got bad shoulders? What advice would you give to someone who simply plays because he enjoys the, you know, what Feinstein's book, A Good Walk Spoiled?
Well, exactly.
You know, what advice would you give to somebody like me?
I would say a couple of things. Always wear as boring as it can be. Work on your short game, the simple stuff. Not having three putts, not hitting a second shot from the first place. So don't dump a chip and have to hit the same one over again. Or don't leave a shot in the bunker. Get everything out onto the putting green in one swing. That'll bring your handicap down and your enjoyment up in a heartbeat. And I think, too, learn how far you hit every club. And don't be caught up in, you know, oh, it doesn't go as far as it used to. But that's how far it goes. So that's where I'm going to go play golf and choose a set of tees that'll be fun.
All right. So I'm going to ask you to go into your golf voice again, and I'm going to tell you about back-to-back holes. And this has probably been 20 years, maybe even more than that, that this happened. I didn't play very often. I played four or five times a year, and I was the alumni director for a small college. And we had an alumni tournament, and I was playing with the chairman of the alumni. And he was also on the board for the school. And we teed off on this course, and it's a dogleg par five. And I said, as I tee off, I don't play very often, so I'm going to try and cut that corner.
Well, that makes sense.
And well, I'm going to go, I'm not going to, you know, my thinking was, I don't get a chance to try this very often. Back then I could hit it fairly far. And so I tried it and I cut the corner, and I'm, you know, 200 yards from the front of the green. Now there's a lake in front. And so I step up there, and after I hit that drive, Dean says, so you don't play very often. It's your first time out this year, huh? I said, yeah, it really is. I step up and I say to him, I'm going to go for the green. I don't play very often. I don't get chances like this very often. I'm going to go for the green. And I cleared the lake and I put it on the front side of the green. And he goes, you're not out here every week instead of doing your job, huh? And I said, no, I was lucky. And so I step up for my eagle putt, and I've got about a 40-foot putt. And he looks over at me, and I said, hey, I don't get a chance at an eagle putt very often at all. I'm going to hit it firm, and I'm going to go past it. I'm not going to leave it short. And I drained it. And he looks at me, and he says, how many days a week are you in the office? And I said, sure, three lucky shots, Dean. So I stepped to the second hole, which is a par three, and I took a six.
Oh, you hold it.
Now, I took a six on the par three, and he says, I believe you. You're in the office every day. So what I want you to do now I've told you that story. You're walking alongside us, and you're announcing my second hole. In your most polite golf voice, talk about the fact this guy just eagled it, and now he's not all there.
Well, Nick, how cruel is it? You go from making eagle to making six. It's the karma of golf, and never, ever say you got it. Correct?
That's perfect. I'm going to record just that and put it on my website for, you know, a professional broadcaster.
Never say you got it.
Yeah. Announcing my golf game. All right. Let's talk about your book. You mentioned a little bit about it. Just give us more description what the book is about.
The book is about mostly about my mentor, George Pulver Sr., was a founding member of the Northeastern New York PGA section, was a heck of a player, as I found out as I was researching for this book. I didn't even know how good a player he was because he didn't, A, like talking about himself, and B, didn't like talking about his golf game. In fact, as you read the book, it's letters that he wrote to me, or it's the main core of the book. So after every lesson, when we started working, in the summer that I turned 15 years old, he would type out on his hand, on the manual typewriter. You remember the old paper that even kind of was a little crispy all there. And he'd leave it in my mailbox. It never even was mailed. He would drive by my parents' house, leave it in the mailbox, and away you go. And oftentimes also there was a book assignment in there. So had your boss or whoever you were playing with in that tournament actually shook your hand and kind of just felt properly, you would have been okay. Because if he had felt calluses on your hands, he would have known you'd been playing a lot of golf. That was one of those Sam Snead stories that was in one of the Mr. Pulver told me to read. So it was about mentorship. It was about education, the fundamentals of the game. He had some pretty slick humor in there, self-deprecation. But really, just about that golf can just take you so far. And don't be afraid. Always be aware of learning. And don't be afraid to make mistakes. Look for other people's strengths and see if maybe there's a little bit you can glean from them. But it was also, it was a relationship that was at its time. I think there was a bigger force in there because I needed a teacher. My dad had taken me as far as he could in the game. And Martha Pulver, his wife, had just died. And as it turns out, his children were really worried that he was going to really lose the zest for living. And they were, as I said in the book, really like Carl and Ellie Fredrickson from Up. They were together all the time. Even if it was just her out beating a few balls at the driving range, or they were up taking soil samples at Brookhaven, they were together all the time and they adored each other. And when she passed, it was exactly the time I needed help. And I reached out to one of the kids, not knowing that Mrs. Pulver was as sick as she was. It turned out to be the perfect medicine for both of us.
Talk about why you felt the need to write the book.
There's so much in those letters, David, that they didn't need to be sitting in a 3-ring binder in my office. They needed to be shared, as well as the letters I wrote back to him. There's so much that we think it's new about golf with the TrackMan and the pressure plates and all this technology that we have. And they're teaching the same thing that he taught and that people that he gleaned from taught. It's just taught in a different manner. So I think it was paying homage to someone who was so important in my career, but also a little cautionary tale to people who get so caught up in youth sports and having to travel everywhere to find competition, when in fact he was a 1 foot in front of the other philosophy sort of guy. And he believed in really dominating and learning how to win and win big. And taking things step by step.
Is it out?
It's out. It came out April 19th. It's available on my website, dottiepepper.net. And, I'm personally, I'm packaging and shipping every one of them. So it's a pretty organic project, but I'm hoping that sales go so well that we can turn around and take the proceeds from the leather bound and the hardcover and do a large run of the paperback so we can get it on the market for less than $15. It's just a really well done book, and his knowledge it's really evergreen. So I'm hopeful. It's been off to a very nice start. And we're giving 10% also back to the Saratoga Warhorse to help veterans who have come back with post-traumatic stress through off the track thoroughbreds.
That's really cool. Now, will you sign them if people go to your website?
Absolutely. There's a spot at the checkout for personalization and any requests.
Okay. And last question, would CBS let you talk about that book while you're analyzing a shot or setting up a shot, but will they let you talk about that?
Oh, Frank Novello teed it up this past weekend for it. Yeah. My coworkers have been really supportive, and, Ian Baker Finch is reading it right now, and he's just like, wow, how did that, the relationship, that just doesn't, it was 81-year-old and a 15-year-old, and we were bonded instantly, but I knew he was so special, and until I went through some of the files that his son left for me when he passed, I had no idea that Mr. Pulver had saved every letter that I wrote him. So there was a pretty emotional, just about this time last year when I found out that in that stuff that George Jr. had left for me, that all the letters that I wrote to him were there too.
That's really, I was going to ask you what the best part of for you of having a book. I've published 22 of them, and each one is different. Each one, has highlights of it. I'm guessing to know how important you were to him has to be the highlight of all of it.
It was. And I think too, we bookended it so nicely. Well, Kathy Whitworth did the foreword, and she had a similar relationship with Harvey Pienick, who was also with Tom Kite and Crenshaw and all those great players coming out of Texas. And it was very much the same sort of relationship. So having the opportunity to ask my first Solheim Cup captain to write the foreword for the book and her actually saying, yes, I got to tell you, that was a highlight too. And then there's a pullout section that I did a Zoom recording with Judy Rankin for about an hour. I learned things about my mentor that I had no idea. So those are all in the book as well. And that was, there were some really special moments just going in the preparation of the content that you would, and you know, from doing so many, some things that you think are so small become so big.
DottiePepper.net. That's the website. I'll encourage people. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to jump on as soon as we get through recording this and order one, and I will look forward to reading it. And it's been a pleasure to have you on with us. I've always enjoyed listening to you, and now I feel like I know you. And if PGA or LPGA ever brings you to Kansas City, we'll definitely get together.
Yeah, I think it would be a great city for the LPGA, don't you?
I do. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us, and you have a great day.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.